Excellent. This is Chair Hopkins. Is there any way that we could scan the camera up to see the large screen? Online, if you could please mute your phones, please. You can already hear the echo happening. Everybody who's calling in, please mute your phones.
And Chair Greyer?
Chair Hopkins?
Yes, that was. Mr. Putman, thank you.
Yes, we are calling maintenance to see if they can come move the camera up so that it'll be pointing at the large screen behind you.
All right, thank you. We'll give that just a moment. In the meantime, we can start with some of our protocols for the call. I don't know who we have online yet, so we're going to be doing a roll call here in just a minute. But as we already heard before, please make sure that your phone is muted when you're not asking a question. I also recommend that you mute your computer, if that's what you're watching it on, through AKL.TV or your television screen if you're watching it through some fancy casting system. It will reverberate and echo through the computer, through the phone system. So before we get started, I would like to remind members, like I said, to mute your cell phones when you're not asking a question. It's going to be critical for today. I would like to go ahead and call this meeting of the House Transportation Committee to order at 1:32 p.m. Today is Tuesday, March 2nd, 2021. Because we're all on the phone at this point, I'd like our House Records Clerk, Jamie Buhner, to call the roll. Ms. Buhner, can you please call the roll for committee attendance?
Representative Drummond. Representative Hannon. Representative McKay.
McKay is here.
Representative McCabe. Representative Kronk?
Here.
Representative Stonholtz? Chair Hopkins?
Yes, Ms. Buhner, I am here as well. Fortunately for us, we do not need a quorum today because we're not taking any business. So, hopefully those members who are not present can join us soon through the telephonic system, and when they arrive, I will note their arrival. I'd like to remind all our presenters and committee members that we are obviously all on telephonic lines today, so again, and I know I've said this a few times, please keep your phone on mute and your computer on mute when you are not asking a question. Two other points of protocol: when you do ask a question, for our committee members and for our presenters as well, when you answer that question or you're speaking, please make sure to identify yourself. This is not for my own information. This is for House records, because they have to write all these minutes down and they have to note who is speaking. We can all certainly sound alike from time to time, so please make sure that you identify yourself before you answer your question. Second point, all of today's presentations are going to be page numbered, and you can, of course, find them on the Documents tab, which I'll walk through in a second. As those page numbers are, as those pages are numbered, please reference the page number that you are going to be asking a question about, or what the page number is that you are working off of if you are a presenter. For those listening in via teleconference, or for those trying to find the documents as committee members, just click, if you go to the akledge.gov, you can click on the tab at the top right labeled meetings, then select the House Transportation Committee link, and you can select the documents tab there. We just have one that we're working from, so it's far less confusing than trying to figure out which subcommittee document we're on. Trust me, I've had this problem a couple times today. This one's easy, I promise. Are there any other questions before we have business today? Oh, before I get to that, wanted to note that we did have Representative Sarah Hannon arrive at 1:34 is when the text message got into me, and Representative Sponholz also arrived at 1:34 p.m. Thank you both for attending the meeting. Do we have any other questions from any members of the committee? All right, hearing none, I will assume that everybody has their documents in front of them. Deputy Commissioner Rob Carpenter is going to be here with his team today to give us an overview on the Alaska Marine Highway System. Mr. Carpenter, please put yourself on the record, identify yourself, and reference, as I said, what slide you're working off of as you go forward. And for any questions of the committee, Mr. Carpenter, if you could take a moment to pause at the end of your slides so that we can see if anybody has any questions. And at that point, committee members, please go ahead and chime in, and I'll keep the talking order. Thank you very much. And Mr. Carpenter, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Rob Carpenter, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. I have with me today Captain John Falvey, the General Manager of the Marine Highway System, and Matt McLaren, the Business Enterprise and Development Manager for Marine Highway. He's also the finance guy for the system. He'll have a lot of the numbers, cancel a lot of the numbers questions today. It's nice to see you all again. We just had a brief meeting in the House Finance Subcommittee, and I believe most of you are on that, if not all of you. I hope to be able to provide more answers to the questioning that went on in that earlier meeting. If we could move ahead to slide two. This, we're just going to go into a little more detail on the routes that we cover. Again, we had a smaller version of it in the prior meeting, but today you can see here, this is the southeast region of the state, and we cover everywhere from Bellingham, Washington, in the bottom right, all the way up to Yakutat in this region, and we go all the way through Ketchikan and all those other communities you can see in there. The vessels that are serving this area are the Matanuska, the Kennecott, the Conte, and Latuya. The Matanuska, of course, is one of our mainliners, and she basically goes from Bellingham all the way to Skagway, and in between, and hitting stops in between. The Kennecott herself goes from Bellingham, and she will go all the way to Yakutat and then go cross Gulf up to the southwest part of Alaska. And we'll show that on the next slide. And then Lakanti, you're all familiar with, is one of our, she hits all the, what we call the village runs, and Gustavus, Hoonah, Pelican, Angoon, et cetera. And Latuya is a day boat that runs Ketchikan, Metlakatla daily, and provides, I think, is daily services, not twice a day. Any questions on this slide?
Any questions from members of the committee? Does not sound like it. Please proceed with the presentation. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Moving on to the next slide, slide three. This is, again, a depiction of our southwest routing. You can see at the bottom right where the orange line would represent the Kennecott going cross Gulf after she leaves Yakutat and arriving in Whittier. That's her primary run there. She generally stops in Whittier, except you'll see off to the left the Tustamina, which is the white line, goes Homer Kodiak. And then when she does go out the chain, out to Dutch Harbor, is when you would see the Kennecott move in and replace the Tustamina for while she's out the chain to provide that service. And then we have the Aurora, which is just coming out of dry dock or very soon, and she generally serves the Prince William Sound area of Whittier Valley, Valdez, and Cordova. That's probably most of this slide. Any questions?
Any questions from the committee? Thank you. Just making sure I give them time to find the mute button on their phones. I do have a question. Yeah, it can get difficult on myself. Then I end up hanging up on things. In terms of frequency of these stops, what is the longest duration between any of these stops between when they get serviced by the Marine Highway System?
Mr. Chairman, good question. I guess it would depend on the time of year. Like many communities get very little service in the wintertime where they would get more in the summer. Are you speaking to, like, in the summer, like, for example, this coming summer season, the chain run is, I think, help me out, Matt. Matt, are you online? Is it twice a month or?
Yes, I'm here. For the record, this is Matt McLaren. Matt McLaren, business manager for the Marine Highway System. Mr. Chair, to answer the question, in the summertime, the white line dilution chain, this coming summer, we are going out the chain once per month, and that's a one-week round trip to get out there and back. And while the Tuscania runs out the chain, the Kennecott backfills that service between Homer and Kodiak. In the wintertime, meaning from October through April, we do not go out the chain just because the rough seas and the weather that can get out there during the winter. And then Prince William Sound, the green line there, the Aurora run in Prince William Sound makes continuous round trips through Prince William Sound each day through the summer and the winter, as long as we have funding available, too.
Thank you on that. This is still Representative Hopkins. On that, I'll follow up on that one. When you say when you have funding to do that, has that decreased in recent years with decrease in funding, or has that been an on and off again pattern in years past?
Mr. Chairman, in the past couple of years, as funding has decreased, we have scaled back service there in the winter. What we did this winter that we're in right now, we've have not cut service there, but we've used the Kennecott running from Bellingham up to through southeast to Prince William Sound and then over to Homer Kodiak. So we have continued to get service in all those areas this winter, but it hasn't been as frequent as if and when there's more funding available, we can keep the Aurora running through the winter and the Tuscania running through the winter more often.
Would the current, this is Representative Hopkins on a follow-up, would the current budget proposal from the governor allow that winter run to continue to happen?
Mr. Chairman, the governor's budget does allow more service than we did this past winter. We will have to lay up the Aurora in October, but we would have the Kennecott running and covering that schedule there as well. And then the Tuscania would be laid up beginning in November. But we do a little bit the same as we did this past winter with the Kennecott, although it won't, with the governor's budget, it decreases the amount of time that we're going to have to use one ship to make all that service. So we do have more service with the Aurora and Tuscania than we did this current winter.
Thank you for that. Was there another question out there? And please identify yourself when you ask your question.
Chair Hopkins, Rep. Hannon.
Please proceed. Thank you.
Thank you. Through the chair, could you tell me, because I have not looked at the summer schedule as it finalized, is Cake and Pelican reflected in this upcoming summer's schedule when it finalized, because the initial draft left both of those communities out?
Through the chair, reps in Hannon, yes, the Pelican and Cake are in the summer schedule. When the original draft went out, it was just an oversight. It wasn't intended to cut those ports out, but within a couple of days, we redrafted the documents, and they are in the schedule Pelican will begin the same, they'll begin one round trip a month, and then Cake will be serviced by the Matanuska, and so they'll be getting service as well.
And follow-up question?
Certainly, Rip Hammond, go for it.
Thank you. And were you able to, through the chair, my expectation is that we're going to have a very high demand for the Bellingham runs, especially when the cruise ship port closure of Canada was announced. Have we increased our ships coming out of Bellingham to accommodate what could be a very profitable season for that run?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, we do have regular service out of Bellingham. We've got six stops there a month, once per week with the Matanuska, and then once every other week with the Kennecott. But what we have done and what we've seen with the demand and what we're seeing coming in this summer, there's a lot of demand without the cruise ships to get cross Gulf, to get from Bellingham up to Whittier so they can get to interior Alaska, to Denali, and some other things in interior Alaska. So we have increased the cross Gulf run. We're having the Matanuska out of Bellingham feed the Kennecott in Juneau, so that those on that week that the Kennecott's not going all the way back down to Bellingham, those people who want to go from Bellingham and up to Whittier can switch ships in Juneau and continue on their journey north with the Kennecott. So we feel that that'll help our revenue quite a bit and help with those people that are wanting to see Alaska this summer when there's not cruise ships around.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, go ahead. Please identify yourself and ask your question.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, it's Representative McCabe. So I'm through the chair, I'm curious about the ridership or the capacity of the Kennecott and maybe the ridership you projected in the summer. I understand across the whole system, your ridership right now is about 60-some percent. On that particular route, what you're calling Cross Gulf, I guess it's Bellingham up to all the way up to Whittier and then Homer to Kodiak. What is your ridership, and what is the break-even point for ridership? Is it 70%? Is it 90%? Is it 100%? Or maybe you don't. Maybe you never break even with 100%. Full seats. Do you have any of that idea on that particular route? Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe. This is Matt McLaren. Yeah, we on that route. Really well on all routes, our revenue comes from the car deck. The passengers, we don't sell out very regularly. COI limits are pretty high, but our limiting factor is the car deck size. And in the summer, in the past, when we've had the Columbia running out of Bellingham and also the Kennecott Cross Gulf, we really only need to hit about 70% on the car deck to get our break-even point. And we have been consistent with that in the past summers on that from Bellingham and the Cross Gulf route, especially what we're seeing coming up. There's a lot of military moving. J-Bear's got a lot of military going up there now, and then a lot of military heading to Kodiak too. So that route is looking to be in high demand for the military as well this summer. So in the summertime, that we, even in years past, even though our passenger capacity hasn't hit 100%, like I said, we don't have to hit 100% to break even on that route. So we've been doing well. That route does pay for itself in the summer and helps to fund some other routes that are maybe not have as high of utilization on them.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Well, certainly, Representative McCabe. Thank you. Go for it.
So I appreciate that. And through the chair, I'm wondering if you can decrease the frequency enough in the wintertime so that you bring your ridership, and I'm not just talking passengers, I mean cars and passengers, total revenue, if you can bring that up decrease your frequency enough? And I asked this question in the previous meeting, so Mr. Carpenter is aware of it. But if, can you decrease your frequency enough to bring the ridership up to make it a break-even point on that cross golf, on the Kennecott cross golf in particular? Thanks.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, we are looking at that too. This this past winter was the first year we did a, I don't want to call it an experiment. We were kind of pushed into it because our revenue was so low as a result of COVID. So we've had to kind of, you know, since our cash flows weren't as high, ridership was lower, we've limited passenger capacities in order to keep our crews and passengers safe from COVID. But with that and our ridership down, we did do that Kennecott. We've limited the frequency from Bellingham. Like I said, the Kennecott was on a two-week round trip from Bellingham all the way through southeast up to Whittier, Prince William Sound, and also Homer Kodiak. So it was covering essentially the entire system with that one ship in the winter. We did see a lot of demand on that route, but we're still looking at that data, and that's something we'll be looking at in future years as well as, you know, where that sweet spot is, I guess, of maximizing revenues and limiting costs.
Thanks.
Thank you. Are there any additional questions from the committee on this slide? All right, sounds like no. Please proceed to slide number 4.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rob Carpenter, Deputy Commissioner. Moving on to slide 4, I'm going to hand this over to Captain Falvey. He's going to give us a detailed kind of update on each vessel and where it's sitting right now. Captain Falvey?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Captain John Falvey, General Manager, Alaska Marine Highway System. Hopefully everybody can hear me okay. On slide 4, what we have here is, you know, our effort to show the committee our fleet mechanically. And we've named it an aging fleet. And if you look to the bottom of the slide, you'll see, you know, the lifespan of the average commercial ship. I'm talking about oil tankers, container ships, roll-on, roll-off ships, commercial ships in general. From the time a company, let's say, for example, builds a new ship, they usually surplus those ships anywhere between 30 and a maximum of 35 years. So, you know, with that as a baseline, what I'd like to do is just run through the ships that we have, every single one of them, including the ones that are laid up, starting with the oldest, and then I'm going to work vertically down and then across the page to the newest ones and, you know, give them just a little idea of mechanically where the ships are. So I'm going to start with the Malaspina up in the top left-hand corner. That was one of the first two mainliners built in the system in 1963. That one, the Matanuska. They're 58 years old. The Malaspina is currently laid up. The reason why the Malaspina is laid up is currently to obtain and continue to have a COI, a certificate. The ship needs approximately $16 million worth of steel repair work, probably more once we got into it and faced discovery steel work. We also know that this is, in essence, the only ship in the fleet that's got original engines. They're 58 years old. They do need to be replaced. Replacing those engines, somewhere around $30 million. That, along with a needed overhaul, and any discovery steel work you might get into, we feel would be north of $50 million at least, just to keep the ship running. And when we look at the current budgets that we have and the amount of ships we can run, we opted to lay that one up. So that one is here in Ketchikan, and it is laid up, you know, for now, anyhow. I'm skipping to the bottom of the page because we're kind of going through its sister ship, the Matanuska, also 58 years old. The Matanuska is a solar ship. What that means is it has the safety features built into the ship to allow it to service Prince Rupert. Prince Rupert is an international port, and only two of our ships, the Matanuska and the Kennecott, are allowed to enter into Prince Rupert. The Matanuska, even though it's 58 years old, about a year and a half ago, we repowered the ship. We did major, you know, we put new engines in it. did a tremendous amount of work in the engine room. So the engine room basically is brand new for the most part. And we also did, per a Coast Guard request, that's something called a major conversion. When you get into spending a lot of money and a lot of disruption to a ship, in many cases, especially if it's a solar ship, although subchapter 8 ships, like, you know, some of our other ones also require it, you have to bring as many of the safety type things on the ship up to, let's say, for example, present day SOLAS conditions. The Coast Guard did allow us to waive some things that would have been too expensive to do. It's a good thing. It makes the ship safer. It brings it up more to, you know, a SOLAS standard. So between the repower and the major conversion, you know, we spent north of $40 million over about a year and a half. So in essence, the ship's really in very good shape, and it's got new engines. It's currently running right now, and it's doing really well. Going back up to the middle of that line, to the Tustamina, our current Tustamina, that's 57 years old. We've spent quite a bit of money on the Tustamina over the last 6 to 7 years, starting with a major overhaul that we did about 6 years ago. We were almost in the shipyard almost a year. Tremendous amount of steel was replaced, a lot of work on the ship. We've, of course, done overhauls every year since then, more steel work. And what we're doing now is we are putting together, in addition to the overhauls, smaller federal projects that can be done prior to the ship going into its overhaul. For example, the ship's been in Seward Shipyard since last fall. We conducted, with federal dollars, a federal amenities program, and that was, we did quite a bit of work on the interior, everything from lighting to flooring to tiles to updating the head, the restrooms, some work in the galley, things like that. I'm also putting together another federal project right now, a little bit bigger. It's about $744 million that we will again do next fall when the ship goes in prior to its overhaul, its regulatory overhaul, to continue to do upgrades, continue to make, you know, improvements, maybe some more steel repair and replacement. In essence, we're trying very hard to keep that ship in as good a condition as we can until we eventually build a new Tustamina replacement vessel. And so the Tustamina is in good shape. She's in overhaul now, and we've spent quite a bit on it to keep it running, you know, efficiently and safely. Moving to the right side of the chart, we get into the smaller ships, two of them, the Lakani and the Aurora. I'll start with the Lakani. That's a 235-foot ship, smaller, 47 years old. It historically operates out of Juneau, Lynn Canal, Haines' Gagway, and the Panhandle. And that ship right now, a few days ago, came into Ketchikan Shipyard for its annual overhaul, and we don't expect any surprises there. We have a little steel work to do. We are going to conduct a federal amenities project on that one while we're here, and no real major issues with the Lakani. The Aurora, she has been in Ketchikan Shipyard for 7 or 8 months. It's been inside the big shed where we've replaced a tremendous amount of steel. We did get some extra funding, some supplemental funding last year to get the ship running again. The ship had been laid up because of steel work, because of you know, things that needed to be, you know, done to the ship to get a COI. So that ship has had a lot of work done, a tremendous amount of hull steel replacement, interior steel. We did while we've been in the shed, also a federal amenities project, interior stuff, upgrading habitability type things inside the ship. It's coming along really well. We're on time, we're on budget. We're going to put the boat in the water this Thursday, and it's doing well and looking really well. And it's in its overhaul part of the process right now to get certified. And on April 15th, it'll be up running in Prince William Sound again. And I know the citizens of Prince William Sound will be very happy to have the Aurora back, as they've had for a very, very long time. The Columbia, it's 47 years old, the largest ship in our fleet. Currently, it is in a cost savings layup here in Ketchikan. It's in what we call South Berth. That's a state-owned berth, so there's no cost for it to sit there. The Columbia is going to go in for a yearly overhaul, get a certificate. That'll be in about 3 weeks. And we've got some steel work to do on that ship. We did discover some steel work, not extensive, but steel work nonetheless. So we will be doing that. We're also, as I speak, working on a federal project to replace the controllable pitch propeller system on that ship. We did repower the Columbia about 5 years ago with federal dollars, although did not at the time have the extra federal funding to replace the controllable pitch propeller system. We actually couldn't at the time because of Buy America steel issues. There were no controllable pitch propeller systems built in this country large enough to, fit the need of what the Columbia needs for a shafting and propeller system. Since then, a company called Wärtsilä, which is the same company that manufactures the engines of the Kennecott, has started a U.S. manufacturing base for controllable pitch propeller systems the size that we need. So we've now, gotten around or, being able to work with, Buy America issues in this country. So we are designing a project for this fall and this winter to install a new controllable pitch propeller system. As they say, that system is original to the boat, 47 years old. We had some issues. We had a failed propeller that got very costly a few years ago, and there are vibration problems with the system that experts can't seem to pinpoint. So it is time for a new controllable pitch system. We do feel that going forward, the Columbia has a place in our scheme, and after next winter, Columbia will be ready to go and should be in really good shape, especially with new engines only 5 years ago. The Kennecott, that is the second solar ship. That's our newest mainliner, 27 years old. She is currently in the bigger shipyard here in Ketchikan, and she will be leaving March 18th. She's on time, on schedule, on budget. No major issues getting the Kennecott through overhaul this year. No steel issues. Kennecott's in really good shape. Moving to the right, the LaToya, she's our smallest ship. She runs from Ketchikan to Metlakatla 5 days a week, and she performs very, very well, close to break even with that boat, especially in the summertime. But she does really, really well. She's in great shape. We've just finished her overhaul. It's a smaller ship, so the overhauls usually last 2 to 3 weeks. And we've done that. We're also planning on late next fall doing a federal project to completely paint the ship, the hull, the decks, and completely sandblasting it, recoating it, and that'll be a federal project, and doing also some work on the inside. I'm going to move over to the two newest ones, and then I'll end with the fast ferries. The two newest ships are the Tazlina and the Hubbard. In essence, both opened in 2019. The Tazlina does have a certificate. It's currently in the shipyard going through an overhaul now. Both boats have had forward starboard side doors installed. The reason being it will make, when we eventually do get to run these ships, they'll be much more flexible getting to many more of our ports, especially in the Panhandle, out of Juneau. So the Tazlina, is going to be ready to go should we need it this summer. Should something break down, we could call on the Tazlina, but right now we don't plan on running the Tazlina or the Hubbard. The Hubbard's here laid up in Ketchikan, and to this point, because of our scheduling scheme and our budgets and whatnot, we've not operated the Hubbard, and we have not gone through the certification process. I was asked a question just the other day if we wanted to get a COI for the Hubbard, we would basically, you know, have to put it into an eight-week overhaul. There was maintenance, minor maintenance that would have to be done. We would have to go through all of the certification inspections. It's quite extensive. We would have to put a full crew on it for 8 weeks, and they would, you know, be in the neighborhood of about $1.5 million just to get a COI on it. So we've not done that in an effort to try to save some funding if we, you know, aren't planning to use the Shipwright as we speak. So that leaves the two fast ferries, Fairweather and Chenega. I'm sure most people are aware of those two fast ferries. They're 16 and 17 years old. Those boats are for sale. We made a determination a year and a half and 2 years ago to cease operating those boats. They're very expensive to operate. They operate under what's called the International High Speed Code. That can't be changed, cannot be changed because of the way the boats were constructed and built. There is a much greater amount of personnel, licensing, and certifications that those boats need because of the speed, because the boats are going so fast. The boats are very expensive to maintain. The boats struggled in heavy seas in Lynn Canal and Prince William Sound. They frequently on Lynn Canal would ingest logs, which can damage the jet drives, and they really didn't handle the weather very well. And when you look at the fuel consumption and the overall cost to run these boats weighed against the payload, because they in essence carry the same as amount of people in cars as the Lakani and the Aurora, they're just very, very expensive to operate. And unless you're running these boats full all the time, it's very hard to even get close to a break even. So those boats, we did put out a sealed bid offering, and we did have one responsive bidder. It's an international bidder, a company from the Mediterranean, and they bid not only on the two fast ferries but on the two spare engines. We have two brand new spare engines in hermetically sealed containers that have never been used. That was all part of the repowering legal lawsuit that we had with the original engine manufacturer. The engines that are in there now are not the original engines. We had a lot of trouble with those engines, and the manufacturer ended up replacing all eight of them at no cost, maintained them for 5 years at no cost, and were able to purchase the two swing engines at a good price. So we are currently working through the process of closing that sale with the international buyer and with their attorneys in Anchorage. So that's where we are on physically the condition of the ships, and I'd be happy to take questions and try to answer them if possible.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for that. I have one question from Representative Sponholz, and then whoever that was, just go ahead and ask it afterwards. Representative Sponholz, if you could identify yourself and ask your question, please.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. This is Representative Sponholz. Through the chair, I have one comment. One is that I think the Kennecott's only about 23 years old. I have two daughters that were born in 1998, so let's give Kennecott 4 years back. But I have a question about the SOLA or SOLAS that that is required for the international service. Can you talk a little bit about what that means? And then a second question is about federal funding sources for ferry repair. Thanks.
Through the chair, Representative Sponholz. Yes. SOLAS, what SOLAS is
I'm sorry to interrupt you, sir, if you could identify yourself as well for the record. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, for the record, Captain Falvey, General Manager. Through the chair, Representative Sponholz. SOLAS is a set of international rules. They're not United States rules. They're international rules. And what it is, it's mainly, in place for ships that run out in the ocean, out at sea, you know, that have to go out into the ocean, out at sea, to get to foreign ports. And because these ships are out at sea, they're required to have many, many more safety features on board built in everything from fire protection, fire boundaries, firefighting, life-saving, being able to evacuate the ship, things like that. Now, the catch that we get into, going to Prince Rupert, even though Prince Rupert is an inland port, I mean it's inside the international inland boundaries, we still, because it's a foreign country, fall into the, I want to say the trap, but the situation where any of our ships going into Rupert, which is a foreign country, have to abide by the SOLAS regulations. And it is much more expensive to build a SOLAS ship, much more expensive to keep a SOLAS ship maintained. So that's what's going on with SOLAS. And it's all about, as far as we're concerned, Prince Rupert and being able to service Prince Rupert.
What does SOLAS stand for? Does it stand for something, or can you spell that out?
Safety of life at sea.
Great, thank you. So my second question was about ferry funding sources for ferry repair.
Captain Falvey, through the chair, Representative Sponholz, we receive approximately $23 million a year of federal funding for repair. We, of course, can't use federal funding to operate with, but we can and do for repair, plus the state match. So would that answer your question?
What is the funding source?
Captain Charlie, through the chair of his Rabbinian Sponholz, that's federal highways, you know, for the most part, and on occasion, federal transit.
All right, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you very much. I believe that. Sorry, was that Representative McCabe who had a question before?
Yeah, it sure was. So thank you. And through the chair, Captain Falvey, it's Representative McCabe, also a captain, just of a different type of vehicle. I'm curious about the doors on the Tazlina and the Hubbard. You mentioned that the Tazlina door was done. I assume that's the refit of the door to make it fit the docks that we use. And I'm also interested in hearing about the crew bunk installation or the crew rooms installation on these day ships, if that's still an issue or still going forward. And if the Hubbard has had the door refit as well.
Yes, Captain Falvey again here, through the chair, Representative McCabe. We installed forward starboard side doors on both the Tazlina and the Hubbard, and the reason being is to make them more flexible at just about all the ports that the ship could possibly go to with or without crew cabins. Right now you've got a stern door and a port side aft door. That's the way the boats were built. And, you know, we did operate the Tazlina, you know, with those two back doors from Juneau to Haines and Skagway in the past or in the summertime. But it becomes very awkward to be maneuvering vehicles in and out of the back doors. So therein lies the reason. As far as the crew quarters are concerned, the boats were built without crew quarters. The crew quarters, in essence, would allow the boat to run 24/7. In essence, a lot more flexibility as to where the boats could go, because without the crew quarters, we fall into a 12-hour day. Potentially, we could stretch that to 14 with permission from the Coast Guard. Usually, we have to put more crew aboard to accommodate that. But, you know, as day boats, they're very restricted as to where they can operate in Prince William Sound or out of Juneau. We do have cabins designed, you know, and, you know, we know how we would change the ship if we were to put crew cabins in the ships, and we know what the approximate engineer's estimate is as far as cost.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Most certainly, Representative, go for it.
So, Captain Falvey, thanks for that. I appreciate it. And through the chair, so I'm curious, If the crew cabins that you've designed, if they're going to cut into revenue, in other words, you know, are they going to take away car space on the deck, main deck, or are they going to take away passenger seating or any of that for these crew cabins, and how it will affect your revenue generation? And I'm also curious about the 12-hour rule. Is that a Coast Guard rule or is that a CBA rule?
Captain Talby again here, to the chair, Representative McCabe. No, the crew cabins would not affect passenger spaces, passenger, you know, amounts of passengers we could carry our cars. There's no effect there. Yeah, the 12-hour rule, it's not really a Coast Guard rule. It's in the Code of Federal Regulations, so it's a United States rule that, you know, works its way down to the Coast Guard enforcing it.
So one more time, Mr. Chair. So
yeah, just go for it.
Okay, thanks. So it's a CFR. Would you mind, maybe you could email me the CFR code that is in? I'm just a little unfamiliar with it. I see it in your contract with the, I think the master's mates and, or no, yeah, the master's mates and pilots has a 12-hour defined day. But I'm curious of the Coast Guard regulation, and maybe they match up. I don't know, but it looks to me like it's a CBA thing and not maybe not Coast Guard. I don't know enough about that. Thanks.
Yes, Captain Talby again, through the chair, Representative McCabe. No, it's a United States requirement that's embedded in the CFRs, and we could provide that information for you. Yes, sir.
That'd be awesome. Thanks.
Yes, sir.
Rep Hopkins, this is Rep Hannon.
Yes, go for it, Rep Hannon. Thank you.
Thank you. Through the chair. Captain Salvi, the Malaspina you mentioned is in long-term layup, and it's like on the next slide, our intention is to sell it. You made mention that the Columbia is at the state dock where we have no mooring fees for keeping it there while it's in layup. Can you tell me, with the Malaspina, what's it costing us per day to have it laid up, and what's our time frame for putting it up for sale versus paying for storage and moorage if we aren't intending to repair it?
Captain Felby again, through the chair, Representative Hannon. It is laid up at a private dock, and I may refer that to our business manager. I'm quite sure I know the number, but he's got these numbers better than I do. So we'll save that. But no, it is there laid up, and you know, we've had some internal discussions about surplusing the ship, but nothing definite at this point. We were kind of trying to take the fast ferries, you know, kind of one at a time, you know, and we're quite sure that we've got the deal set on the fast ferries, and then I would imagine that we would then look to the Malaspina as far as surplusing or something like that. And I was wondering if Mr. McLaren could provide Representative Hannon with the cost to lay up the Malaspina over a course of a year or by the month.
Yes, for the record, this is Matt McLaren, business manager for the Marine Highway System. Through the chair, Representative Hannon, the cost for the Malaspina right now is averaging just over $8,000 per week. So we're running close to $450,000 a year for the Malaspina being laid up. And that includes mooring costs, security, and utilities that are needed for the ship.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, go for it.
How long, through the chair, how long have we had the Malaspina in a layup status where we are spending money to keep her stored?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, the Malaspina was officially laid up in mid-December of 2019. So up until before this fiscal year, we had spent $233,000 on laying up the Malaspina. In FY21, we expect that cost, if we don't do something with the ship, will be about $450,000 this fiscal year on top of the $233,000 we've spent in the past.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Are there any other questions before I circle back to Representative Sponholz from people who have not asked any questions yet? Doesn't sound like it. Go for please ask your question, Representative Sponholz.
All right. Thank you very much. Through the chair, in talking about the, I was interested in the Taslina and the Hubbard again. It sounds like it wouldn't reduce our passenger capacity to create crew quarters, and it would make them more efficient. What would it cost for us to build out those crew quarters?
Captain Falvey again here, through the chair, Representative Sponholz. Our engineer's estimate right now is approximately $15 million per ship.
Okay. And follow-up?
Yes, please, go for it.
All right. So so I hear that, you know, that there's kind of a couple of opportunities, options for, you know, ensuring that we've got consistent service to folks in the Upper Lynn Canal. One would be, you know, retrofitting them to add the crew quarters, or two, to create a ferry terminal at Cascade Point north of terminal. Is a DOT planning to proceed with either of these options? Is there a preferred alternative from your perspective?
Mr. Chair, this is Rob Carpenter, Deputy Commissioner. I could jump in on that question. Is that a yes? So through the chair, Representative Sponholz, you know, it's a great question, and we're pursuing kind of both of those angles. I don't consider them mutually exclusive options at all. Cascade Point provides that shorter route. One of the working group recommendations is, of course, leveraging our road system, and developing Cascade Point does just that. It takes 30 miles off that route. However, one of the challenges out there is it would likely be a seasonal terminal, given the seas that pile in Lynn Canal and hit right in there in Burners Bay area. It's pretty nasty. So the challenge is, what do we do the rest of the year? And that's, to me, is where crew quarters comes into play. Those ships can run out of Auk Bay. They can run out of Cascade, one or two of them in the summer, and then the rest of the year they can run out of Auk Bay, or maybe have one in Prince William Sound. But you know, the key on this is, and we'll get to it in a later slide, but what those crew quarters really do is provide us some reliability to the system and provide flexibility and allow us to do more things when our older ships are failing, which seems to happen a lot these days.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please identify yourself and go ahead and ask your question.
Sure, it's Rep. McCabe. If you don't know my voice by now, I'm really upset. I'm not sure if this is for Captain Falvey or Mr. Carpenter, but how much adding crew quarters means, of course, you have to add crew, and I'm wondering how much that increases your operating cost per hour, if you have that figure, or maybe it's a per-trip thing, I'm not quite sure. And if there are crew quarters on the ship, does the crew always have to equal the crew quarters? So, in other words, if you put crew quarters on there and you're supposed to have a double crew or a captain and the double crew, would you have to have a double crew even if it was a day trip or only for those trips? And I assume the 12 hours is a duty day, not a underway time. So I'm just a little confused. I see some discussion in there where one of the Juno Haynes, maybe Skagway Juno trip is pushing 12 hours. So I'm curious about how the interplay of how all that works.
This is Captain Falvey again through the chair, Representative McCabe. I can answer part of that, and I think I'll turn some of it over to our business manager. As far as the crewing, I can answer that. The crewing wouldn't materially increase because as a day boat, we have a night crew on the shore side in addition to the day boat that's running the actual boat. So with or without the cabins, the crew really doesn't increase. As Deputy Commissioner had mentioned, we may want to dual purpose these ships with cabins, where we might be running out of Cascade Point and then at other times of the year running out of Juneau. that comes down to the CBAs. That comes down to, just working with the unions to, get the agreements that we need, to efficiently and, cost-effectively operate the ships. I think Mr. McLaren might have some thoughts on revenue also, as far as with or without cabins.
For the record, Matt McLaren, business manager of the Marine Highway System. Through the chair, Representative McCabe, with the crew, we do have some challenges, too, without crew quarters. What we had to do this the past summer when we ran the TASLEAN up Lincoln Canal with the distance from Juneau to Haines to Skagway, what we ended up having to do in order to even stay within a 14-hour day is overnight the crews in Haines just because of the length of the run, which that in itself added quite a bit of cost. We were paying about $25,000 a week just for hotels and per diems for the crew in Haines. So one of the things the crew quarters do, it decreases that cost. We've got the crew on the ship. They can get their rest during the run. We can make longer runs and meet the work rest requirements that we've got to comply with. And as far as revenue, we feel that it will actually increase our revenues because we can service more ports within a working day, which increases capacity on the routes that we run. It is a bigger ship than we're running with a Lakani, so it's got more card X space. And like I said, as we can increase the day length a little bit more, that increases that capacity and frequency to all those ports that we feel will translate to higher revenue as well.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. I'm going to chime in here with a question of my own. Assuming the deal goes through to sell the fast ferries to warmer climes for the Mediterranean, what will happen to the revenue from that sale?
This is Captain Falvey again. Through the chair, Representative McCabe. The revenue from the sale will go back into a fund that we call the Rust Construction Fund. It is a federally eligible pot of money that's required by federal law. Okay, we had to get permission from Federal Highways to sell the boats, and we've got that quite some time ago. And as part of that, once the sale is finalized, those funds will, in essence, they could go to other federally eligible pots of money within DOT, but our plan is for those that go into the Bus Construction Fund to be used again on a Marine Highway federally eligible project, and we'll report back to Federal Highways once that's done.
Thank you very much for that, I assume, because we'll be hearing this in the budget subcommittee, and I'll have some more questions about what those federal allowances will be for it. So I'll certainly have some more questions about that coming up later in those other subcommittee meetings. My next question has to do with the agreement with Vigor for maintenance done on these ships. Can you please go into a little bit about what the agreement with the AMHS and Vigor is for the shipyard in Ketchikan, I believe, and what levels of maintenance can be done by crew versus having to be done by Vigor back at the shipyard or out and about? Can you please go into some detail and talk about that agreement?
Yes, Captain Falvey again, through the chair, Representative McCabe. Some of your question on my cell phone broke up. I think what you
just,
were asking
just, sorry,
is,
just one second. Sorry, for the record, for the future, this is Representative Hopkins asking, not McCabe. No problem with you.
Hopkins,
just wanted to make
okay.
Sure I got it for the – yes, sir. Please go ahead with your question. And the question was if you could talk about the agreement with Vigor and what the maintenance agreement is for that, what levels and size of maintenance can be done by the crew versus having to be brought back to either Ketchikan or contracted specifically with Vigor and how that agreement works.
Well, we do have an agreement with not only Vigor Shipyard, but now with Seward Shipyard also, now that they're back in business, owned by the JAG company. And it's an extensive agreement, and it breaks down, various costs of just about anything from painting to to welding, to repairing things. It's very detailed. It's very broke down. We negotiate that. I believe it's every 3 years. I think we've just renegotiated that. We've been, of course, got a contract with Seward Shipyard. When we do bring any one of our ships, in for an overhaul, we pretty much have a full crew. We may cut back on the passenger services staff a little bit, but there is a lot of work that's also done by our crews that necessarily wouldn't be done by bigger shipyard, things that the crews have on their to-do list and whatnot. And I don't know if that answers the question.
Not completely. So I'll go ahead and follow up. Are there small scale maintenance efforts that the crew can do while they're out there, whether it's fixing a drain on the ship or a handle on a door or a larger scale handling anything at the actual operations of the vessel? Is there anything that the crew is able to do while on the ship as opposed to having to bring it in for a complete overhaul?
Yeah, this is Kevin Salvi, through the chair, Representative Hawkins. Well, we need to come in for the overhaul, in essence, every year to renew certifications and inspections. So the ship needs to come in to have that done by the United States Coast Guard, by the American Bureau of Shipping, which is our classification society. We send a lot of equipment off, the life raft, the firefighting gear. So to renew the certificates, the ships do need to come in, and we have a system where we do fleet condition surveying yearly. We actually have a subcontractor that helps us with that, and we have maintenance requests also that are sent in by the crews over the course of a year, and we have a team of engineering and deck management staff that work with the crews to effect what exactly are we going to do as far as their requests. And yeah, they do perform a lot of the work on the ships. It's kind of a group effort between our ships that are almost fully crewed, getting work on a lot of the things that they need to get done while the ship is stopped, and the things that in essence they're not able to perform, in essence done by the shipyard.
The
crews do work and do maintenance work on the ships. And along with working with the regulatory bodies, with the inspections and the drills and all that. But there is maintenance performed by our crews during these overhauls. Yes, sir.
Thank you. And are those delineated by cost, by size, by type of small repair that needs to be done by the crew there? How is that delineated out with it in that agreement with Vigor and the Seward Shipyard?
It's Kevin Falvey again, through the chair, Representative Hopkins. What we do is, cost always comes into play, but what we try to do, given our budgets, every ship has a budget. We every single one of those ships that goes in has a different budget. And we try to build those budgets based on need. What is the most important thing for us to do to keep that ship safe and running safely and following all the rules and regulations? So we work downward in level of importance, and cost comes into play. But if something needs to be done, it's going to get done regardless of the cost. So that's how we try to plan it, and it's budgeted into every single ship for every single overhaul. And we do that by committee. We work with the crews, we work with shoreside staff, we develop a plan. Each ship goes in with a plan and a goal to get certain things fixed according to the need.
Thank you. And when you look into what the budget is for those ships and how it can be used, do you do it with an eye towards cost savings, towards ensuring that there are people on board who can do small repairs? How do you evaluate that? Because I continue to hear that there are very small repairs that need to be done by Vigor or by the Seward Shipyard that can be done by somebody on the crew with a simple few hundred dollar purchase or less than that.
So I'm trying to get a handle on what the guidelines are for that. Is it certain types of maintenance? Is it a cost threshold? Is it location nearest to either Vigor or Seward? How is that delineated out, and how do we try to ensure that there's cost savings to make a more efficient system?
Well, I mean, as far as the state overhauls go, per statute, I believe the maintenance work has to be done, within the state. That's law, I believe. And it also stipulates north of a certain line drawn in the sand, ships operate.
Oh, I believe we lost you.
You know, must go to the shipyard. That's how we get to what shipyard we're going to go to. But then once we get there, and we go on the game plan, and small jobs that may be on a list to do. A lot of it's mechanical stuff, although this deck stuff too. The chief engineers, they coordinate a lot of that work. And I guess what I'm getting at is they're not allowed, to do those kind of repair jobs.
All right, thank you. That's certainly counter to what I've heard on a number of small-scale anecdotes, and we'll flesh that out some more in the budget subcommittee. Thank you for that.
Sure.
Chair,
are there any other questions on? Oh, yes, Representative Hannon, go for it.
Thank you. Through the chair, Captain Falvey, I want to go back to the Tustamina and sweet age of 57, and I've heard previously that it is time that we have a replacement vessel for that, and we have a replacement vessel fund. And can you tell me what are the plans for the Tustamina at 57 years old and the long-term ability to serve the communities that she serves currently out the chain?
As far as the new Tustamina, we are designing the new Tustamina. We're at about 60% completion as far as we're moving forward with the design, and there's probably another year or so to go to finish the design as far as the design. As far as funding, I might send that over to our deputy commissioner.
Yep. Mr. Chairman, Rob Carpenter, Deputy Commissioner. Representative Hannon, Captain Falvey, as Captain Falvey said, we're about 60% design, which is the bulk of the design, I guess, not quite the super detailed stuff, which still needs to happen. He was cutting in and out, but I think he mentioned we're looking to go to get a CMGC, a construction manager, I shouldn't have brought that up because I can't remember the name of that acronym. But the point is you get a contractor on board that does the build, and he helps with the final design. Construction manager, general contractor, that's what it is. Thank you. For the funding side of it, that's been our real challenge. Once it's fully designed, to come up with that construction money is the hard part. She's penciled out at about $238 right now, $238 million. And that's non-soulless. If we go soulless, that's another 20% on top of that, which would be another $46 million or so. So it's a hard pill to swallow all at once. Our funding options, obviously, are through our Federal Aid Highway Program, which is around $600 million a year. And as you probably know, we have demands for all over the state for all of our highway systems. So we're trying to get be creative in some way to finance that ship when she is ready for construction. We're looking at things like infra grants from Congress or build grants or Garvey bonds or some other way to make the hit to the statewide the STIP, if you will, the Statewide Transportation Improvement Program, which is the the program that guides the federal aid highway money. So the hit to that program is not as big and severe in one year. So again, we're looking at options, working on grant applications, and we'll be happy to continue the conversation with you guys on how we get that boat funded.
Follow up?
Yes, Rapana.
Through the chair. Mr. Carpenter, do you know how much money is in the vessel replacement fund currently and what we would expect to generate off the sale of the Chattanooga and the Fairweather?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I believe the vessel construction fund has about $19 million in it right now. And I should mention also that we have an appropriation for the Tustamina replacement, which has about $22.5 million of state money for matching federal funding. So we kind of have a good chunk of the match set aside. We don't have an appropriation from the vessel construction fund, but that's certainly some money that could be used. And then the sale of the fast ferries, whatever that, I don't remember the number off the top of my head exactly. I'm not sure if it's public yet, but whatever that amount is, that would also, a point I was going to make, that would require an appropriation to use that money. That was kind of overlooked previously, but whatever that amount is could certainly be used as well.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, if I could just make one final comment on that. It underscored for me when we had a plane accident, a fatal plane accident in Dutch Harbor, I guess 18 months ago now, and the airline pulling out of serving that community and looking at the number of people that transit in and out of that community that were suddenly struck with charter flights, perhaps with unskilled pilots. And, you know, when we've got a large private sector industries trying to work out of there, and we had no option to provide transportation. And granted, the Tustamina does not generally run in the winter, but you know, it was really striking that we've got a major hub port that generates a huge amount of revenue for the state, and we had no commercial mechanisms to service that community for a period of time. And it underscored for me the need to have vessels that can serve our port. Because that's a tricky airport to fly in and out of.
Thank you. Rep. Hannon, are there any additional questions on this slide? Doesn't sound like it. Please proceed on to the, looks like we covered probably most of the AMH. Yes,
Rep. Mr. Chairman, this is Representative Drummond. Has any thought been given to what the new administration in Washington, D.C. has in terms of plans for an infrastructure plan and how we can take advantage of that to provide the federal funds for the replacement vessels that we're talking about?
Mr. Chairman, Rob Carpenter, Deputy Commissioner. Representative Drummond, absolutely. I mentioned the infra grant earlier. That's a grant. I can't remember what authorization act this became effective, but they're upwards of $100 million. And I wouldn't say they replaced earmarks, but they're kind of that, follow that, that kind of idea, and that I think there's some, political sway and how those things get granted out. And so we're trying to, you know, we're talking to the congressional delegation all the time, trying to say, you know, if you're looking for ideas, these are things we, you know, we have needs on. And then the infrastructure package, we're as excited as anyone to see what's in it and how it's funded, and more than willing to supply information to anybody that's looking for ideas.
That's great, Mr. Carpenter. I hope you are able to take advantage of it. And I think, as I said earlier in the budget subcommittee meeting, if you present the Alaska Marine Highway as one of the largest state-run transportation systems in the nation, they might pay more attention to our needs. You know, looking at a small population state that delivers people and goods over such vast distances surely they can be persuaded.
No, that's a great point. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Thank you. On that note, for my own follow-up information, I know that the Washington State Ferry System is looking at creating more electric ferries for some of their obviously much, much shorter runs than we do. Has DOT looked into the possibility of electric ferries for shorter runs like the Latuya, Leconte, and Aurora?
Mr. Chair, can you handle that one, Captain?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. This is Captain Falvey again, through the chair. Representative, is this Drummond? Was that asked the question?
Representative Hopkins, thank you. Sorry about that.
Hopkins, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry. Actually, Representative, we have had a contractor look into, you know, the shorter runs, and that's really where, you know, you'd be able to use, you know, the battery technology. It's improving every year, and that's true. You know, the Latuya, the, you know, Lynn Canal run, that, you know, would work, but it would require major work, you know, redesign, you know, as far as that sort of an effort on any of those ships. You know, whether you'd want to try to take a ship that is currently operating with diesel engines and convert it as opposed to starting from scratch and build an electric ship, it's about a 50-50 thing. So, but we have looked into it. I would also like to note that all of the new engines that we've installed, the Columbia new engines, the new engines on the Matanuska, the new engines that will go on to the new Testamina replacement vessel, are all LNG convertible very, very, very easily. They're dual purpose engines, so we're thinking that far ahead as far as LNG, which is cleaner and, generally speaking, more efficient. The problem is supply chain coming into Alaska with LNG right now doesn't exist. So, yes, we have looked at electric ships, but kind of a toss-up when you're looking at spending a lot of time and money, and would you get that back with the electric powered ships with, you know, trying to reconvert the ones you've already got.
Thank you for having listened to that. I appreciate that. So in terms of time, we have about 15 minutes left, and I wanted to make sure that we got enough questions in that are not going to be on solely budget items that we'll have plenty of time to go into in the budget subcommittee. Looking forward, in your slides, the historic traffic and operating weeks, slide number 8, can we skip down to that one unless anybody has any specific questions about slide 7 first? But I think I'd like to skip ahead to slide 8 and start back up from there. So, presenters, I think we're good on questions there. So if you wanted to go ahead and start on slide 8, the historic traffic and operating weeks.
Okay, for the record, this is Matt McLaren, business manager again for the Marine Highway System. So on slide 8, it's showing us a couple things here. The yellow lines on there, the vehicle traffic per year. So we're going back about 30 years of history here, and then the blue lines represent the passenger traffic on this slide for each fiscal year, and then the red line going across the top, bumping up and down, is the number of operating weeks for that fiscal year. A couple things to that jump out at us here. The yellow set lines across there shows our vehicle traffic has been pretty consistent, and like I said earlier, that's where the majority of our revenue comes from, is our vehicle traffic. Passenger traffic has declined steadily the last few years.
But as you can see, our passenger traffic flows pretty closely to the number of operating weeks that we provide. Looking back at 2005, 2006, we did have 2007, 2008, we did have some increases in passenger traffic there, but you can see our operating weeks also jumped up dramatically as well. One thing we noticed as we were analyzing that, our operating weeks between 2004 to 2008 jumped up about 40%. We went from operating just over 300 service weeks to about 425 service weeks in 2007. So, but our passenger traffic didn't necessarily correlate with that increase in operating weeks. We had a 19% increase in passenger traffic during those years. So it didn't quite go up the same correlate in straight line with the number of operating weeks we increased.
Quick, this is Representative Hopkins. I have a quick clarification question. Can you please define what operating weeks is on this graph?
Sure, Mr. Chair. So an operating week is defined as a week that we have a ship operating. So for example, let's say one of our vessels operates 50 weeks through the year. So that's 50 operating weeks. If we have a second vessel operating the same 50 weeks, then that's a total of 100 operating weeks. So it's possible in the summertime where we have seven vessels operating at one time. So there's seven vessels operating that week. That would be seven operating weeks, even though it's only one calendar week.
Thank you. That makes sense. And then this includes the LaToya, which I'm assuming runs pretty consistently throughout the year and not in as rough waters or as much concern as the rest of the fleet might have. Can you please provide us this graph with the LaToya schedule taken out of that? And I don't need it to go back all 30 years or so, but that red graph, that would be more realistic for the overall amount of ship traffic for the Marine Highway is what I'd be looking for, with the LaToya taken out of this so it's not skewed in that direction.
Mr. Chair, yes, we can provide that. We can look at the last few years a little bit closer on the next slide if there's not any other questions on this slide also.
If there are no questions, please go ahead and proceed to that next slide.
Okay, so slide 9, this shows the past 10 years of ridership with a little more detail. It shows the actual numbers of passenger vehicle traffic each year. Of course, FY20 was down quite a bit because our operating weeks were down due to COVID, and we had an IBU strike during that year. So that, of course, wasn't budget-related, but, you know, outside circumstances kind of dictated less operating weeks. As you mentioned, the LaToya, Mr. Chair, the LaToya represents it averages 50 operating weeks per year. So looking at these operating weeks here, if you subtract 50 operating weeks, that'll give you a good – that'll give you the number of what our service level was with taking the LaToya out of the account. And then our passenger ridership for LaToya is about – averages 33,000 per year. Vehicle traffic, I believe, is about 18,000, but we will – I can provide you a new chart with all of the LaToya accounts removed from this chart.
Thank you. That would be appreciated. And if you can send that to my office, I will go ahead and share it with the rest of the committee. Thank you.
Sure. Okay. So for the sake of time, I guess we can kind of move on unless there's other questions on this slide.
Feel free to move on. Thank you.
Okay. So slide,
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, we do have one question. My apologies.
Oh no, Mr. Chairman. This is Rob Carpenter, Deputy Commissioner. Is the intent to get through these slides, and should we go fast, or what are you thinking?
My intent at this point, with the last 5 minutes or so in committee, is to more or less talk about the non-budget specific questions
that the committee might have. If we don't have any non-budget specific questions, we can go back to those graphs, but I think maybe if we wanted to jump forward towards slide number 12, the tariff increase history would be a great place to start. So unless there's any specific questions on those green graph slides, why don't we skip to slide 12? Thank you, Rob. Thank you, Mr. Carpenter.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Matt, want to take off with slide 12?
Sure. Again, this is Matt McLaren, Business Manager, Marine Highway System. So slide 12, we just labeled out our tariff history. This shows the increases we've done since May of 2015. Prior to that time, to my knowledge, there were no specific tariff increases since the early 2000s. So these are the most recent years of tariff increases. We had a tariff analysis done by an outside group, and part of the recommendation was to levelize our tariffs. We had, previous to this time, we had close to 24,000 different tariffs throughout the system, and there's no equity for distances or anything else. So we made our tariffs based on a formula. The commissioner decided, you know, we don't want to implement that full formula at one time, so decided to level that over a four-year time period. So this just shows as that happened and those tariff increases. And then on the next slide.
Before you leave that slide, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Hannon has a question on slide 12.
Thank you, and I just the first time you've used the term tariffs, or is that interchangeable with fares in the Marine Highway System, or are these separate from fare increases?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, they would be interchangeable, yes.
Thank you. If you don't have any follow-up questions, Rep. Hannon, please proceed to slide 13.
Okay, slide 13. In October 2019, we implemented dynamic pricing. What this does is it tries to match the tariffs or the fares with the demand on that route, or as the car deck fills up, as cabins fill up, as the passenger capacity increases, the tariffs or the fares also increase. So this table just shows the percentage of capacity booked and then the amount of increase of the fare above our base fare. We had since October 19, of course, there were, you know, COVID hit early 2020, so we haven't really had a traditional normal year to look at the impacts of this, but what we have seen is during that time, just compared to our base fare, we have seen a 9% overall increase in revenue. So if we take that 9% and look at a normal operating year of roughly $50 million of revenue generated, we expect to see around a $4.5 million revenue increase compared to if we would just left the fares at a flat rate. So any questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Rep. Hannon, go for it.
Thank you. Mr. McLaren, or is this Mr. Carpenter? I lost track. Was any analysis done of doing dynamic pricing with the inverse? So instead of charging more as you got closer to sailing, that you were discounting fares to try to fill the deck because the cost of sailing between two ports was going to be the same whether you had 50% of the car deck full or 75% full?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, that's something that has come up recently, and we are, I know, in discussions with the commissioner's office as well as far as what, you know, maybe looking at
lower demand routes, or as sailings get closer, looking at other options to try to fill up that car deck, or fill up the car deck or passenger deck, whatever the case may be.
Mr. Chairman, and I just one comment on it. I, especially in the last year since the dynamic pricing went in, it is one of the areas that I get the most constituent complaints over, because let's say you had a scheduled trip and you'd booked far in advance to get the lowest fare, and then your trip was canceled. So now you were still faced with, you had to go, and now you're buying a ticket just a short time in advance at 50% increase in cost because your original sailing was canceled. And so it was an extremely frustrating element in the year of COVID for consumers to adjust to, and it really seemed to not make sense in many occasions, where the default dynamic pricing wasn't because of poor planning from the consumer end.
Thank you, Rep. Hannon, for that. As we're shutting down for the 3 o'clock time frame for our committee, I want to thank all the presenters. Are there any other questions before we close out? I have one more. Thank you. One thing we wanted to touch base on was the AMHS Reshaping Ferry Group. Can you please touch on what, in the last just 5 minutes here, really quick or less, what the recommendations were from that restructuring group and reshaping group, rather, and what we can expect going forward from the results of that group's discussions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rob Carpenter, Deputy Commissioner. We weren't really prepared to speak to those, but I can tell you we're working towards, some of them are already in motion, I should say. Things like leveraging the road system with, you know, Cascade Point, things like dynamic pricing. And there's things we want to work with the legislature on. Some of the recommendations are needing legislative action, like revising a new, for lack of a better term, MTAB, the Marine Transportation Advisory Board, having a new revised board of some sort that would require legislation, and, you know, budgetary action. So there's some things in motion, some things we'd like to work with the legislature on this session, and we're looking forward to further discussion on it.
Thank you very much. And I want to open up the opportunity for the committee to email me and my staff any questions that you might have that we're not able to get today. I'd be happy to put those together and forward them on to the department and the presenters here today so that we can get some answers, because I know there's a lot of interest in this topic and only so many hours in the day. Thank you very much to all of our presenters today. I appreciate your time here. Our next meeting with the House Transportation Committee will be Thursday, March 4th. That's this coming Thursday at 1:30 p.m. Please note that time change from our usual 1 p.m. meeting. It'll be in the same room, room 124. I'm hoping that I'm out of my hotel room and I'll be able to be there in person. Please remember that immediately prior to that meeting, we will be meeting as the House Finance Subcommittee for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, and that will be up in the House Finance Room from noon to 1. So it will be very similar to the structure that we had today, except that we'll actually be in person for the 1:30 meeting. At least that's the plan now. Thanks very much, everybody. And if there's no further business to come before the committee this meeting, we'll go ahead and adjourn at 3:03 in the p.m. Thanks very much, everybody.